Ladies and gentlemen, I want now this evening to pass from the ancient world of Homer and the Old Testament and the Indians to some of the views, naturally I can't discuss them all, which are current now about human beings, about this piece of work which is a man. Well, the interesting thing is that the ego remains very much what it was in Homer's day. It is this conscious, fairly rational creature which uses words, which is analytical, which pursues its own self-interest. It is the person, in the words of Robert Louis Stevenson, the person with a conscience and a variable bank balance. But around this ego, around this person with the variable bank balance, there are a whole number of not I's. The I is surrounded and to a great extent controlled and manipulated by this whole series of not I's. Well, as we saw in the ancient world, these not I's were classified by Homer under such names as Thumos and Phrein and Cardia, the midriff, the heart, this power in the chest. In the Old Testament we have such phrases as the heart, the reins, the bowels. And on top of these physical and psychophysical entities, there were, in all the ancient conceptions, these supernatural creatures which made inrushes and which affected the life of the ego. There were actual possessions by named deities and by unnamed daimons, and there were also, we get in the Old Testament too, we get Samson being possessed by the Spirit of God and being able to perform these prodigies of strength in the battle. And we also have these kind of impersonal forces which are yet directed by supernatural powers from the outside, which Homer calls arte in regard to the negative forces which lead us to disaster, and menos, the positive forces which enable us to perform actions which normally, in our normal state, would be almost impossible for us. Well, today, we still have the body with us, which we classify and talk about in a rather different way, and which I shall speak about towards the end of the lecture. But in regard to the menos and the arte and the supernatural possessions, we observe the same phenomena, but of course we speak about them in a different way. We speak about them in terms of an active, dynamic unconscious. Well, it's remarkable how recent this idea is. We now take it completely for granted, but actually it is an idea which William James dated exactly. William James attributed the beginning of the new psychology, with its stress upon the dynamic unconscious, to the publication of a paper in 1886 by F.W.H. Myers. And Myers was a profound, and I regard him as one of the best students and describers of the unconscious mind. Naturally, his fame has been completely eclipsed by that of Freud, who in a sense I think was less complete than Myers. We can generalize and say that whereas Myers was chiefly concerned with the positive side of the unconscious, with the unconscious as giving us menos, these accessions of strength and power and insight, Freud, who was a physician dealing with sick people, was mainly preoccupied with the negative side. Myers was concerned with menos, and Freud was concerned with arte. And Freud says of his own theory of the unconscious, his words are, we obtain our theory of the unconscious from our theory of repression. His idea was, this is, I needn't go into it in any detail because it's perfectly familiar, that discreditable desires and drives are pushed down out of consciousness because we don't want to confront the fact that we have such drives and desires which are at variance with the cultural pattern of our times. And they are pushed down, but they remain alive and cause a great deal of trouble underneath the surface, express themselves in these symbolic and roundabout ways, and altogether behave very much as the possessing daimons of Homeric times. It's interesting in this context to find that our colloquial language still preserves many of the ideas which we inherit from Homeric days. For example, when we do something particularly stupid or delinquent, we say, I don't know what possessed me, what can have come over me. Or we say, he can't have been himself when he did that. All these, that's very interesting as showing how strong this ancient idea of being possessed by somebody else, how strongly it persists in our minds. And of course, subjectively, the activities of the negative unconscious definitely feel like a possession. Then, of course, along with the discreditable drives which we repress, we also repress painful memories. Traumatic experiences are also pushed down out of sight and also create a great deal of trouble in the basement of the mind. Freud, so to speak, is talking all the time about the basement downstairs with the rats and the black beetles, whereas Myers is largely concerned with the floors above the ground floor where the ego lives, and he would agree, I would think, with the mystical point of view that the topmost floor of these upper levels has no roof to it and is open to the sky, but we will go into that later. Well, over and above the negative unconscious due to repression, there is, of course, a large negative unconscious and also a positive unconscious due to early conditioning. Conditioning, of course, is something which everybody undergoes in the course of childhood and is completely necessary to adapt the growing child to his social environment. But, of course, it can also be extremely dangerous and produce very bad results. Pavlov, in his classical studies of dogs, showed that conditioning is particularly easy when the resistance has been lowered by disease or by fear or indeed by any violent emotion. That at these times it's particularly simple to install a behavior pattern, which is then very difficult to get rid of. We become, in these states of lowered resistance, we become what the poet describes as wax to receive and marble to retain. These behavior patterns can be pushed into us at this time with an extraordinary force. And incidentally, during the Second World War, the whole Pavlovian theory of conditioning under stress and during moments of lowered resistance was used in the treatment of what used to be called shell shock and now is called battle fatigue. It was they used this as the explanatory principle for these processes which they called narco-hypnosis, which were very successful in getting rid of these conditionings installed under distressing conditions. Actually, when one looks at what happens when with people who have had a behavior pattern of a bad kind installed during a condition of lowered resistance, they are reacting to the world here and now as though they were suffering from some kind of, though laboring under some kind of post-hypnotic suggestion which had been given to them in the past. The conditioning in this moment of traumatic experience acts as a kind of post-hypnotic suggestion which makes them do all kinds of things which are wholly irrelevant to the facts of the present moment. I mean, this is, after all, one of the possible definitions of neurosis, that it is a behavior which is not relevant to the present, but is relevant either to one of these post-hypnotic suggestions induced by conditioning in a state of lowered resistance, or else to the response to one of these repressed desires which are still festering in the lower levels of the mind. Now, Freud's has enormous merits and I think also very great weaknesses. His enormous merit was, of course, to stress the immense importance of the unconscious mind, to point out that it was a dynamic thing, that it was continually active, that it continuously influenced the life of the ego, largely, in Freud's view, for evil, because Freud was, as I say, a physician and concerned with sick people, and he paid very little attention to the positive side of the unconscious. This was his greatest merit. And his weaknesses, I would say, first of all, that he paid very little attention to the positive side of the unconscious, and he also paid very little attention to the physical side, the bodily side of the personality. Now, these, I think, are his two main weaknesses, and I shall discuss the bodily side later on. And now let us get on to the positive unconscious, to the menos, the accessions of power which we receive from this this buried mind, this under lower basement and upper stories of our mind. Now, here again, let us look at the colloquial phrases that we use in regard to the positive unconscious. One of the interesting things is that we are curiously humble about our good ideas. Colloquially, we very rarely claim a good idea as being originated by ourselves, by the I. We say, for example, a wonderful idea has just occurred to me. It suddenly flashed into my head. Or we say the violinist played as though he were inspired. Always this idea that there is something which is not the I of our familiar ego life, which provides the good ideas. I mean, it may be actually that I never have a good idea, that the good ideas simply come to me from somewhere else. And this is certainly a very common experience of things simply emerging from the blue into our consciousness. And the source, of course, is this this huge area of the positive unconscious mind, which in many respects is more accomplished than the has greater insights in many respects, I think, than the ordinary conscious ego. Now, the ordinary process, I suppose, of thought goes something like this. We take in material from the external world, the natural world and the social world, consciously. This material is then stored away in the memory and is worked upon by these these not eyes in the unconscious mind. And when we have good ideas, this seems to be the transmission into the conscious mind of the results of this unconscious working under in the basement, or anyhow in some area of the mind which we are not normally in touch with. It sort of comes up to us, and we get the good idea, and then the function of the conscious mind is to verify the idea, to check it, to see if it is actually a good idea, if it's as good as it feels, and if it seems to be coherent and consonant with what we know already. And then after that we can work out the relationship between the new good idea with the other information and the other ideas which we have. This, as I say, seems to be roughly the modus operandi of this conscious and unconscious process. In relation to the sciences, I suppose the best account of the workings of the unconscious intuition are to be found in the writings of Henri Poincaré and more recently of Adamard, who describe mathematical intuitions, these uprushes of knowledge and insight which come out of the unconscious. I mean, generally the process is that the mathematician tries to wrestles with a problem and cannot succeed in solving it, leaves it alone, and then suddenly in a moment of distraction or of reverie, the answer will come into his head. Well, sometimes the answer is correct and sometimes it's not, but it is the business of the critical conscious mind to examine this answer, and in the cases when it's correct, to see what the logical steps are between this conclusion which the conscious mind has arrived at in its subterranean state and the premises from which the whole thing starts. And it is interesting to remark that in his recently published book, Professor Brunner, in his book The Process of Education, devotes a chapter to the possibility of actually training the intuition, training children to retain and to sharpen their powers of intuitive thought. He says there probably is still a great deal of research to be done in this field, but he is very strongly of opinion that this should be taught to children. The children should not have this power of guessing, sometimes correctly, sometimes incorrectly, but above all, that they shouldn't have this repressed by the process of analytical education, and that they should be encouraged and trained to do their intuiting in a, not exactly systematic, but because it isn't systematic, but to do it in a as a regular thing, to be open to this idea of intuition. Now, we pass now from the positive unconscious in the sphere of science to the closely related operations of the positive unconscious in the spheres of art. Here, of course, the whole idea of poetic inspiration has been around for centuries, for millennia. It's interesting, for example, to find that in several of the Indo-European languages, the word for poet and seer is the same. We have vates in Latin, we have fili in the Irish, and we have thulr, I think, is the word in Icelandic, always meaning the same thing, that the poet is the seer. And we have in Homer phrases of, for example, that the minstrel sings out of the gods. And we have this whole idea of inspiration running right through into modern times. I mean, it's interesting to find what numbers of great poets have said about the subject. For example, Goethe says, the songs made me, not I the songs. And Lamartine says, it is not I who think, it is my ideas that think for me. And Musset says, Alfred Musset, one doesn't work, one listens. It is as if some stranger were whispering in one's ear. And then Shelley has a curious metaphor. He says, the mind in creation is like a fading coal, which some invisible influence, like an evanescent wind, awakens to transitory brilliance. In relation to these remarks, it's worth pointing out that the famous summing up of philosophy by Descartes, cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am, was emended by the German romantic philosopher von Baader to cogitor ergo sum, I am thought, therefore I am. Not I think, but I am thought, therefore I am. And there is, I think, a great deal to be said for von Baader's ideas, that the ego naturally retains its immense importance as a guiding critical faculty within the total mind-body, but that a great many of its best ideas come to it from somewhere else. And obviously, I think one of the major problems of education is to keep open this door into the other world where these ideas come from, to help the young person to remain open and aware of these kind of intuitions coming from a deeper level. This allows us, I think, to make a reasonable definition of what is genius. A man of genius, I suppose, is one who has a particularly active positive unconscious and a particularly good one which is furnishes him with a great many novel insights and brilliant new ideas, and at the same time he must have obviously a very good and efficient conscious critical mind which can take the ideas which come to him in this way by a kind of automatism and examine them, see if they are really good, work them out and fit them into, build them up into structures, either scientific or philosophical or artistic, which shall be satisfactory. This, I would say, is the definition of a man of genius, that it is both inspiration and perspiration. I mean, there has to be the thing coming in and the tremendous hard work being done also. Of course, a thing which we must never forget is that some of the uprushes from the unconscious world, in many cases, they are not of the first quality. They may be extremely poor in quality. In this case, we have somebody, say we're talking about the arts, who is working, it might be said, in the mode of genius, but not with the consequences of genius. What he does feels like being a genius, but objectively it looks like something nonsensical. And this, unfortunately, happens quite frequently. There are tragic cases of this. I mean, one of the classical tragic cases is the case of poor Benjamin Robert Hayden, who felt himself to be one of the greatest geniuses in painting that had ever lived, but his pictures are in fact deplorable, although he was an extremely intelligent man. And oddly enough, we get another very curious case of this in a man much more intelligent even than Hayden, which is Voltaire. Voltaire prided himself on being a writer of tragedies, and he wrote one of his tragedies, Catiline, a five-act tragedy in rhymed Alexandrines, in 1 week. And he wrote to a friend, apropos of this feat, he was saying, nobody who has not experienced poetic inspiration can possibly believe this to be true, but I have experienced this inspiration, and here is the tragedy. The only trouble is the tragedy is completely unreadable. So that we see that we can have all the functioning of genius without the results of it. In this case, the uprushes resemble very much the automatic writing which we find in a number of mediums. And here again, if you look at the output of mediums, most of it is a kind of inspirational twaddle. Occasionally, there are messages which look as if they had some kind of veridical quality to them. Still more occasionally, there are utterances of very profound kind of mystical wisdom. And still yet more occasionally, there are quite considerable works of art produced in this automatic way. I'm thinking of the very, very strange case which has been frequently quoted and analyzed, the case of Patience Worth, this historical novel which was produced by a quite unlettered lady in the Middle West who wrote in this archaic English style, which never really departing from the spirit and the vocabulary of the century in which he was writing, a book which is, it's not a very good book, but it's quite an interesting book, and it remains one of the real puzzles of the work of the positive unconscious. Where on earth did this thing come from? She, of course, affirmed that it came from the spirit of some dead person who was speaking through her, but this may or may not be true, but anyhow, there was something in her mind capable of spinning an extremely good yarn and bringing it out, and also, I mean, still more remarkable, of maintaining this kind of historical archaic vocabulary over quite consistently over hundreds of pages. In relation to the storytelling faculty, worthwhile to quote the case of Robert Louis Stevenson, which is one of the most remarkable cases of an excellent author who relied almost entirely on the unconscious mind for his material. He tells us in Across the Plains that all his stories came to him in dreams or in reverie from something not himself. He called this part of him the brownies. He says, the brownies in my head present me with this material, and all I have to do is to work it up into literary form. In the lecture which I shall give in relation to visionary experience, I shall have more to say about this very odd storytelling faculty which seems to be at the back of every mind, but which in certain minds is developed, as I say, to an extraordinary pitch. And here again, this is, I do think, a most fantastic phenomenon, that that this power of invention, of fictional invention, of dramatization, should lie lurking here. Most of us are aware of it, of course, only during dreams or in delirium, but there are certain people to whom this storytelling faculty provides an endless wealth of material, either for their amusement or, if they happen to be capable writers, for the purpose of turning out fiction or drama. Now, before we leave this subject, I would like to mention one of the oddest phenomena of produced by the unconscious mind, the phenomenon of what is called the calculating boy. These children are really, I mean, they seem to be entirely inexplicable. You get these children who have these amazing capacities for doing arithmetical calculations in their head with extraordinary rapidity, and with perfect accuracy. I want to read an anecdote which I'm very fond of about one of these calculating boys who was called Benjamin Blythe, who lived early in the 19th century. And this is a story which his father wrote down about him. His father liked going for a walk before breakfast always, and little Ben, who was then 6 years old, went for a walk with him one day, and as they walked along, Ben said, "Papa, at what hour was I born?" And Papa said, "At 4 a.m., my child." And then he said, "And what is the time now?" "The time, my boy, is 7:52. Ben worked along for a few hundred yards in silence, then stated the number of seconds he had lived. His father took a note of the number, went home, took out pencil and paper, made very elaborate calculations for about 20 minutes, and came out triumphantly and said, "Your answer is out by 172,800 seconds. Whereupon Ben said, "Papa, you have forgotten the two leap years of 1820 and 1824. Complete collapse of Papa, of course. Well, Ben Blythe grew up to be a quite capable mathematician. And there have been... this is a very interesting thing. There are two cases of calculating boys who grew up to be men of genius. One is Ampère, and the other is Gauss. One or two others have grown up to be remarkable mathematicians, have lost their calculating faculty, but have grown up to be and have been quite intelligent and even well above the average. Perhaps the most extraordinary thing is that quite a number of them have been far below the average in intelligence. The most extraordinary case of them all was a German in the middle 19th century called Dase, who was really completely half-witted. He was unable, to the day of his death, to understand the first book of Euclid. But he had this unbelievable capacity for doing sums in his head. And for all his life, for about 40 years, he was paid a small pension by the Prussian government to find the factors of numbers between 7 millions and 8 millions, which he did with the greatest of ease. This I do think presents one of these strangest mysteries. I mean, where on earth does this fantastic capacity come from? It seems really quite inexplicable that that some people should have built into their brains this enormous power of arithmetical calculation, which they don't know how they do it in many cases. Many of them have been asked, "How do you do it?" Some of them have some ideas of how they do it, but some of them simply don't know at all. They just say, I get the answer. That there is some kind of not I sitting down in the basement which performs these calculations and presents the result to the conscious self. And the conscious self may, as I say, be a complete idiot. We just have to hold up our hands with the complete incomprehension. Well, so much for the negative and the positive unconscious. Now let us consider what may be regarded as the deepest of all levels of the unconscious, namely the bodily level. After all, we all go about with a body, and it profoundly influences our personal life. And we know remarkably little about most of its functionings. For example, I give the order, "I want to raise my arm." Well, this is a very simple order, and the arm duly goes up. But how on earth does it go up? After all, we have no idea. We can give this general order, but there is some kind of physiological intelligence within the body which mobilizes the resources of the body to carry this order out. And we now, this has been analyzed, and we see that this process is of immense complexity. There has to be a coordination of nerves and muscles, and below the level of the massive molar level, there is, of course, the cellular level and the subcellular level. There's an enormous organization of electrical impulses and chemical exchanges and changes going on, none of which do we as personal conscious egos have the slightest awareness, nor does, as far as we know, does any part of our unconscious with which we ever come into contact either have the slightest awareness of this, that this kind of physiological intelligence works within us in ways of which we are perfectly ignorant. The Aristotelian philosophers of the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance used to call this physiological intelligence which runs the body, used to call it by the name of the two aspects of the soul, the vegetative soul and the sensitive or animal soul. Now, these are quite useful terms. We mustn't, of course, take them too seriously. They are merely useful as names of processes, but they are by no means the names of functional entities. I shall sometimes use the word vegetative soul as a kind of shortcut for describing certain things which happen within the body. And the interesting thing is that this kind of physiological intelligence has two aspects. There is what may be called the biological intelligence, the sort of generalized specific intelligence which runs our heartbeat, our digestion, which heals wounds when we hurt ourselves, which mobilizes the resources of the body against disease and so on. And there is also a kind of ad hoc physiological intelligence which mobilizes resources of the body to perform specific actions. And some of these actions appear to have no kind of evolutionary precedent, and some of them even seem to have no kind of utility. A very strange and peculiar example of what the physiological intelligence of a quite lowly animal can do is provided by the parrot when it imitates something. Now, let's try to analyze what happens when a parrot imitates a human voice saying something. Presumably the parrot consciously hears the human voice repeating this phrase, whatever it may be, and after hearing it some time, and this evidently penetrates into its mind, such as it has, and then something inside the parrot gets to work and proceeds to organize a noise-making apparatus, which in the bird is radically different from the human noise-making apparatus. We have, after all, tongue, teeth, soft palate. They have a tongue of a quite different shape. They have a beak. They have no soft palate. They have no teeth. And yet the imitation that a parrot can give is sometimes so good that dogs will be deceived by the bird calling out, and they think it's their master's voice. And even occasionally, I think human beings can even be deceived by the parrot's words and think that it is another human being speaking. Well, this is really most extraordinary when you try to think, to analyze this. I mean, that you see that there is something in the parrot, some kind of physiological intelligence, performing an ad hoc act which has no evolutionary precedent and no biological value, as far as one can see at all, performing it in a way inconceivably more difficult than anything that the conscious parrot can do. There is a part of the parrot's mind, this unconscious physiological intelligence, is infinitely brighter than the parrot's conscious mind. Now, in human beings, there are certain analogies to this. I mean, for example, again, the question of imitation, a very tiny infant will imitate the smiles of somebody who bends over the crib and smiles. Again, here is something within the infant which arranges the most elaborate display of muscles to produce this smiling. And we have examples which are very, very strange. I mean, some of you may have read a very curious book which came out, about 5 or 6 years ago by a German psychologist called Herigel, who spent some time in Japan and who studied the art of archery. There is a special art of Zen archery in Japan. His book is called Zen and the Art of Archery. And this is a particularly interesting book because one sees that the whole technique of this art consists precisely in the ego getting out of it the way that when the ego interferes, it just messes everything up. I mean, actually, to make a small digression here, it's quite obvious that what may be called the physiological intelligence of the body is almost infallible so long as it's not interfered with by the ego or by the personal unconscious. The moment some kind of personal anxiety or subconscious anxiety or some other subconscious distressing emotion comes into play, then we are liable to get psychosomatic disorders. That all that the ego can do in relation to these physiological intelligences is to mess them up, to prevent them functioning properly. Well, here in this curious art of archery, what is taught is simply a kind of organized passivity, of a stepping aside of the personal self and permitting this physiological intelligence to do a specific ad hoc act, which is firing the bow. And the bow is fired with the most incredible accuracy. Herigel describes this whole process, and it's extremely interesting, as showing that, like the parrot, we have something within us which is, in a certain sense, much more intelligent than we are. It's one of these extremely mysterious things that we should carry around with us, this kind of extravagantly well-developed intelligence which can do not merely the daily miracles of keeping the body balanced and functioning, but also these strange ad hoc feats which, as I say, don't seem to have any kind of evolutionary precedent, and which it just performs because it's able to perform them. Well, now let's briefly consider another aspect of the body. Now, the word here, of course, the body, is a very unsatisfactory word because, in point of fact, there are actually on this planet at the moment, I forget, about 2.9 billion bodies. And the interesting thing about human bodies is that they're sufficiently alike to one another for them all to be recognized as human, but they are also sufficiently unlike one another for each of them to be recognized as belonging to a unique individual. Um, In general, I think biologists tell us that variability tends to increase in species according to their position in the evolutionary hierarchy, that the higher you go up the evolutionary ladder, the greater the degree of variability, and the highest degree of variability in any species is found in man, that there is this enormous variability between individuals. And this, of course, is extraordinarily embarrassing for the people who want to develop a satisfactory science of man, because after all, science, as we've in the ordinary natural sciences, is, in the words of Émile Meyerson, the great French philosopher of science, I mean, science is the reduction of diversity to unity, the finding of a kind of generalized idea which covers the behavior of all the members of a class. But with the human beings, the differences are just as important as the resemblances. So that to a really satisfactory science of man will require not only the development of general laws of behavior, but also some way of talking about the individual differences between individuals, between special differences between individuals, and the way in which these general laws of behavior are applied in specific cases. Now, plenty of recent work exists which shows that, which stresses the importance of these differences. I was thinking of a remarkable work done at the University of Texas by Professor Roger Williams, whose book Biochemical Individuality points out that on the biochemical level we are even more different than we are from one another in the shape of our faces and bodies, that there are these profound differences. And in his other books he's pointed out that there are striking anatomical differences in the structure of different organs, in the structure of the nervous system and so on, which indicate quite clearly that this immense variability exists among human beings, and that it is no wonder that there is so much misunderstanding between people in the world. I mean, that the fact that we are so very unlike one another is accounts, of course, for the extraordinary difficulties we have in getting one on with one another, and also, I think, is one of the good reasons why we should be tolerant and have some kind of democratic form of government which permits a certain degree of free choice. I mean, if everybody were alike, then some dictator at the top could perfectly legitimately dictate what was good for all of us, because what was good for him would be good for everybody else. But as we are profoundly different from one another, then some kind of regime in which there is a certain freedom of choice is clearly more biologically sensible than a dictatorship. I think this is an important fact to remember. Now, we come from the biochemical dissimilarities to the morphological differences. And here I would recommend you to examine an extraordinary book which came out 3 or 4 years ago, W. H. Sheldon's Atlas of Men. And this is a volume of several thousand photographs showing the entire spectrum of human variability. Sheldon has worked on a kind of systematization of the differences between men, and this sets forth the evidence of his theories. And we see here this extraordinary display of different types of creatures. I mean, it's almost unbelievable that people as different from one another as the people at the three polar extremes of possible variability, it's almost incredible that they should belong to the same species. Incidentally, I'm sorry to say that when one looks at this book, one is struck by the curious ugliness of the human species. And I look forward with horror to the publication of its companion volume, which will be the Atlas of Women. I think it will probably be a book of such an extraordinarily anti-aphrodisiac nature that it should never be put into the hands of a young man. Clear and pictorial form indicates the extraordinary range of variability between individuals. Now, quite an interesting point here I would like to make very briefly is that if you look back over periods of history, you can see that certain types of physique and the temperament, which undoubtedly to some extent is conditioned by physique. No novelist in his senses would put the character of Falstaff into the body of Cassius or the character of Pickwick into the body of Uriah Heep. There is a certain relationship between the physique and the temperament. And as I say, I think in every period of history there are one or two types of physique and temperament which are fashionable and which seem to be particularly useful in that period, and that those who happen to be born not belonging to that type of physique and temperament find themselves very unhappy. There's a poem by William Blake where he says, "Oh, why was I born with a different face? Why was I not born like the rest of my race? When I look, people stare. When I speak, I offend. Then I'm silent and passive and lose every friend." And this is a state of things which many people have suffered from. I mean, who find themselves physically and temperamentally in a world which approves of other types of physique and temperament than they happen to have. Again, it's another very good reason for tolerance and for freedom of choice. In this context, I would like briefly to touch on something which I think is of great interest in regard to physique and temperament. That is to say, the traditional rendering in Christian art of the figure of Jesus. Now, this is very curious. We shall find here that on the whole, there is a fairly standardized traditional figure. In no case, as far as I know, I don't think there is any example of Jesus having been represented as round and comfortable like the Chinese god of luck. And there is no case, I think, either of his having been represented as a kind of bustling, roly-poly figure like Santa Claus. Almost always, he is represented as, I'm using Sheldon's classification, as a 2-3-5. That is to say, somebody with almost the lowest amount of sort of soft roundness, with about the middle amount of muscularity and drive, and rather high in linearity and slenderness and sensitivity. And this, very occasionally, great artists have represented the figure of Jesus as powerfully muscled. For example, in the famous picture in San Sepolcro in Italy of the Resurrection, Jesus is actually more powerfully muscled, more athletic than the Roman soldiers round the tomb. And in many paintings by Rubens, he is represented as very powerfully muscled. And this generally we find offensive. There's an epigram by Blake after when he'd seen a picture by Rubens where he said, "I always thought Christ was a carpenter and not a brewer's servant, my good sir." And this shows how profoundly we are aware of this, the importance of the bodily relation to temperament and to behavior in the world. Now, here I've had much more time, but I would like very, very briefly to speak about this immemorial controversy which has been going on for many, many centuries between the proponents of the of nurture and the proponents of nature, the proponents of the heredity and the proponents of environment. But this, as I say, has been going on in different forms for an enormous time. We get it originally in a theological form, in the problem of predestination or of works. Matthew Prior wrote a very amusing two couplets which sum up the whole problem of predestination. It goes like this. Could destined Judas, long before he fell, escape the terrors of a future hell? Could Paul resist, deny, or not embrace obtruded heaven and efficacious grace? And this, of course, the extreme Augustinians would say no, that they couldn't escape this, that Judas on one side and Paul on the other were predestined to their different fates. And there was this great controversy in the 5th century between St. Augustine and Pelagius. Pelagius was obviously an early British behaviorist because he came from Britain. Pelagius is a fancy name for Morgan. And whereas Augustine maintained that man was born hopelessly depraved, Pelagius maintained, like J.B. Watson, that he was born completely blank. Was a tabula rasa, that was born without tendencies towards good or evil, and that the sin of Adam affected only Adam, and that every child was born as innocent as Adam had been born, and that even an unbaptized child would go to heaven, Augustine insisted that hell was paved not with good intentions but with unbaptized infants. Then, in later centuries, the argument between nature and nurture shifts its ground, and we find in the 18th century, for example, a revival of pure Pelagianism. We get, in Locke, where the man is born as a tabula rasa, it goes further in Helvetius in the middle of the century, asserting that that all abilities are due to education and environment, and that you could take any shepherd boy from the mountains of the Cevennes and turn him into an Isaac Newton, which I am afraid is rather optimistic, to say the least of it. Then you get, at the end of the century, Lamarck with his doctrine that acquired characteristics were inherited. And then you get a sharp reaction in the 19th century with Darwin and Mendel and the later eugenists insisting on the importance of hereditary factors. In recent times, you have had another swing back towards the Pelagian position with the early writings of Watson, who affirmed roundly at one time that he could see absolutely no evidence for musical or mathematical ability being inherited, and that any child could be turned into anything by suitable conditioning. And we have had, of course, for a time in Russia, there was the revival of Lamarckism under Lysenko, who insisted that you could manipulate plants in such a way that you could change, you could cause acquired characteristics to be inherited. It seems pretty obvious that neither of these extreme views is correct. that obviously seems to me that the nature and nurture are synergic, they always act together all the time, and that it's perfectly ridiculous to stress one at the expense of the other. And indeed, if you analyze the realities of the case, you find that if you are a believer in the existence of hereditary factors and their importance, then ipso facto you must be a social reformer, because it is only under good environment that the good hereditary factors can find their full expression. In a bad environment, a good heredity will either be repressed completely or masked or distorted in some way, so that every good eugenist and every believer in heredity, as I say, should be a social reformer, and conversely it seems to me that every good social reformer should certainly take into account the facts of hereditary differences in order to make his environmental training of the young effective. And with this I will close this lecture, which I've run a little bit too long, I'm afraid. Needless to say, I've only touched on very few of the endless factors which modern research has revealed about human beings, but I hope I've touched upon some of them which are of more significance than others, and I trust that you'll find these the modern view valuable. I mean, this sketch of the modern view useful to you in your thinking about individual behavior and about the march of events in the world. Thank you.